This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri, and we are with Samuel Peralta, poet, producer, art curator, physicist, the man who invented the future. And here's Sam with an opening poem.
Thank you, Grace. This is Resurrecting the Dinosaur. Chance meeting at the Tyrell Museum, and you think it's fate. You talk about our past life as if it could be resurrected, as if a passion now glacial could be melted, rekindled into the fire it used to be. You might want to try to draw out the DNA of our desire, our tempestuous archosaurian relationship, resequence the base pairs of the broken code, clone our ancient affection into a molecularly indistinguishable emotion. But you'd have to dig deep beyond the Jurassic layers of this heart to unearth any part of me that might still hold hope. And what is left lies fossilized in amber, frozen in the throes of an agonized death. Or you might try to nudge us back to where we were, taking advantage of the slightest waver of my desire to evolve anew, away from you, like triggering a latent developmental branch during the embryonic stages of a bird, to coax it to spread five delicate fingers instead of three, on each tiny front limb, intimate a jagged whisper of teeth along a formative beak, and curl 22 vertebrae of its fragile spine in and up and around its frame into a saurian tail. Yes, we did love once, but that love's extinction is irrevocable. There is no soft tissue to draw genetic material from, no chemical switch or biological window to turn back time, no course to revert the unwary bird into the dinosaur. And even if there were, best let the past die, buried in the sediments of your memory, lest history repeat itself, lest you recreate instead the theropod of hate that would remember, rise and devour you, a raging tyrannosaur.
The voice of Dr. Samuel Peralta, who has conquered language, a scientist who loves language and uses it and makes poems. Sam, what do you love about poetry?
I love what poetry means to me is poetry is a semaphore. It's a shorthand. Mm. It's a way to express something that's very complicated in a very few lines. So that's what poetry is to me.
Love the semaphore. Love that.
That's why I used semaphore as my Twitter name. In the early days of Twitter, you could choose pretty much any name you want. I was lucky to be able to get at semaphore as my Twitter name.
Perfect.
And all I did
for you
during those Twitter days was to broadcast poetry.
This is what we know about you. We are going to find out every single thing you've ever thought or believed tonight in a short program. Okay, I'm going to ask you four questions and just give me four brief answers because this is your portrait. One, what's a physicist?
A physicist is someone who believes in the God behind the universe.
What is a poet?
A poet is someone who discerns who's the prophet for that God.
What is an art curator?
An art curator is someone who spotlights pieces of that creation for others to appreciate.
What is a film producer?
A film producer is someone who uses visual language over time in order to portray a story.
What is the human heart?
Ooh, hard questions. The human heart is something inexpressible.
I like it. Okay, I've just presented the portrait of Dr. Samuel Peralta, who will give us another poem. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and here's Sam.
This is a poem called Letter to Neruda. You have been my woman's lover now for 7 years, ever since your two souls met at La Isla Negra. Yes, I have known about your assignations for some time, your breakfast tete-a-tetes, your late-night trysts, midday intermezzos punctuated by wine and passionate exclamation. I've unearthed your letters, your amorous affirmations secreted in her books, your verses excerpted in diaries. I beg of you, release her captive heart. You have no need of her. Your mistresses surround you. Innumerable are your conquests. And I have only her. She fills my soul. Without her, I am empty. I love her, and sometimes in her absent eyes, I see the flash of remembrance, and I think sometimes she might still love me too. But I have not your art nor scope. Passion flows like torrents from your pen, where they are quenched from my own. You are a force of nature, an earthquake, a hurricane, and I am left to woo her with nothing but my shop-worn metaphors, my contrived rhymes, my incompetent pentameter. So I have gathered you this ransom, 140 poems, all I have. I have packed them in my well-worn suitcase in verses of small denominations. Take them. Only tell her you will see her no more, that your art is for another, that you'll always cherish your moments together. Then unbind her hands, loose her blindfold, let her run back to me, back to my waiting heart, inadequate but true.
Love does triumph. This is our scientist, our poet, and he's here today for us to find out what makes him work. How can he do this? You are an award-winning poet seen in Canada, the United Kingdom, America. You have been the editor of some 13 books, chronicles. You have written 150 scientific papers. Is this the way that you're trying to make sense of the world, Samuel?
It's a way for me to explore my potential. I don't know where I'm going, but what I want to do is I want to stretch my muscles in poetry and short story writing, in art, any which way I can to see what my potential is. And I will just follow that wherever it leads.
Who gave you that right? Who gave you that wish? Who gave you that knowledge that you were able to do this, that you were entitled to do this, that the world and space were all yours?
I think that the world gives you entitlement. The world beckons with its richness of poetry and story and art and music. And you tell yourself, is that something that I can do? Am I able to make that kind of music? Am I able to make that kind of film? Can I paint? Can I write? And then you try. And sometimes you fail and you find out that you can't do that. And sometimes that you find out that you can speak in a language that no one else quite speaks. And that's the way you find yourself.
That is good. Speak in the language no one else speaks. So what is your success is being more of yourself than anyone could be.
That's
everything you do is that you are more Sam Peralta, as much as you can be. Is that it?
That's basically it.
But you do know math. I have to say that. physics. I mean, who can do long division? I mean, physics. What is physics? Isn't it numbers? Math?
It's a lot of numbers and experimentalism and lasers and all sort of things. But it's really probing the art of the universe, isn't it? There is, you feel like there is someone, the great artist who has painted the worlds and put them in motion. And what you're trying to do is discern the brushstrokes of that great piece of art.
Can physics determine whether this is just a hologram we're sitting in talking? Can physics ever come to that?
It's hard to say. Physics can tell you what the possibilities are, but physics tells you that there are only possibilities. It's 90% sure you're not a hologram, but there's that 10% possibility that you are, and we all are.
We are in a beautiful bubble together with Samuel Peralta, who has pushed the limits of space and pushed the boundaries of literature. And so let's have a poem, and then we'll go further and farther.
This is a poem called Radar. Against the violet sky, my Piper Saratoga banks and shifts, a paltry sparrow lost in the expanding gloom. Dimmed in a room below me, the radar on the island airport circumnavigates the darkness. Its luminescent arm swings a clockwise arc across the screen and pings the rumor of my existence up above. Last month, I stood beneath the wash of the rain shower, the buzzing of your Phillips razor mixing with the water's hiss, love's wondrous morning ritual, familiar as coffee, comfortable, soapy, serene, when I found it. Two fingers retracing open circles from the areola, ranging in spirals across soft tissue, outward like a radar sweep. Like a malign bath scatter off my startled fingertips, a sudden thickening, unaccustomed beneath the surface. There. 2 weeks later, at my callback diagnostic screening, the radiologist scanned the bright Nazca lines of my mammograms, aerial maps pinpointing my pain, this purgatory between parallel plates compressing my world again, again. Last week, a stereotactic biopsy, a geologic intrusion into the core, an after tremor shattering my broken world. 140 knots, 5,000 feet. Rain falls, the wind shifts, and my aircraft wings drop suddenly on a power on stall. If I chose silence, I could ease up, but the winds wash over those pallid wings as I fall. I could close my eyes and let gravity's distant wavelength uncoil and draw the shell into its untethered, unrelenting pull. But here, in the momentary silence of my falling spin, my heart's radar reaches out, probing hope's dim cavern. Pings the summer of our daughter's graduation, pings the showering of rice at her wedding, pings our grandson's wavering first steps, pings him scoring at his first home game, pings us on the shore of Orchid Beach, pings you holding me, crying in the shower that first day, love, as if you'd never let me go. Pings this life, this fragile, precious life. And I must draw my strength into my hands, haul resolution's ailerons back, back, until the curve is righted and the wind is stilled and the airfield markers part the darkness into stars.
Mm. Oh, you bring that home. You really bring that home, Samuel. That is shattering, and it shatters and puts us together at the same time. I have to say that you have created the Lunar Codex Project, which puts work of thousands of contemporary creative artists in time capsules, lunar time capsules, launched with NASA with a program to bring art to the moon. Now, I'm just setting that up to say one thing. Because you are working, sending moonshots to the moon, yet your work is about humanity. And it uses many metaphors that are scientific, but the human heart is what you're really always exploring. Talk about how precious this third dimension is.
I think the human heart is where all art focuses on. There's no way that it cannot come back to that, because it is our perspective. Humanity has to see the world as it feels it. And so it comes to that. I like to say that all my poetry is about love, whether it's about love of children, love for another human being, the love of life, and love is centered around the heart. At least that's the way we think. And I think that's a very important thing. So I think that the soul of what makes the core of what makes us human is a human heart. And by putting the essence of humanity, its art, on the moon, it transforms the moon into something more, so that when we look up at the sky and it's no longer a barren piece of rock with maybe a few pieces of technology sitting on it, but there's more in it. There's culture. There's we've placed on the moon our dreams and our hopes and our thoughts, and we placed in the moon our human heart.
The fact that you have created the Lunar Codex, and this actually puts books, poems, art, actually visual art also, Sam?
That's correct. We've got 15,000 artists now and growing from 91 countries, and that's probably the largest, biggest cultural exposition that's ever been put on the moon. And we've got art, books, poetry, music, and film, as well as images of sculpture and other types of arts, photography. So we started out with art, so there's a lot of art and books, and only now did I open up film and music, but we've already got over 300 pieces of film that's on board, ranging from documentaries about artists to films. There, I've got one film up there that has won an Emmy Award.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, we have to mention that because you have produced and supported over 100 independent films. And one of them, the Golden Globe nominee, was The Fencer. And then you won an Emmy Award film, Real Artists. So you have those going up. But from the conception to the execution, you have this idea. And being a physicist, you knew how A matched B and how to put C. But how did you manage to get the program together with the physicists and scientists at NASA so they would let you do this?
Well, I'm just the bridge. There's thousands of engineers working on the lunar landers, and there are thousands of artists working in the world. And all I did was realize that, gosh, we live in an era now where we can actually have people buying a ticket to be an astronaut. we can't put the common man on a spaceship and fly him up there, but we can take his art and we put it up there. So we've essentially made we've bought a ticket, not for 15,000 people to go up there, but we bought tickets for 15,000 people to send up their poems, poetry, artworks.
Samuel, first of all, how does that happen? Do you compress them into a digital or a microfiche? Can you tell us in a way we'd understand it? And then it's launched and it arrives in the dust?
We do. I'll show you roughly how we do it. This is a card about the size of a credit card. It's coated with gold. And I don't know whether you can actually see it, but you can see it on the website. And what it is, kind of see the images.
Yes.
That actually is a catalog. That is a catalog called Chronicles of a Future Foretold. I curated that art exhibit for Poets Artists, Didi Menendez's group, and 33 Contemporary Gallery. And we compressed that into basically a credit card size so that all the images are, so that's very light. We can't send a catalog up to the moon. And actually, we can't send this either. This is too heavy. So what we've done is we've taken, that's just a demo, a gold credit card. But this is something like what we send up. This
is all of that is on that coin.
This is a disc. No, not really. This is compressed. All of this can be compressed in maybe a section of this coin. So if you look at it, I can't show it carefully, but we compress it about into the size. This is the size of a quarter. Now this contains the entire trilogy of the Foundation novels by Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer. And we've and this is the same coin that has sat in the red Tesla that Elon Musk shot up in his red Tesla Roadster in 2018. Do you recall that?
Yes.
So we're using the same technology to put all that art on the moon. And my technology will put it not on a quarter size, but on a dime, because things have progressed since then. So I've got dime size things, and also for things that we can't compress into this, like film. We can't put film into this. We put them onto special memory cards. And then what we do is we stack them up. We stack them in a sort of sandwich, so that we have a little sandwich of memory card and a nickel-plated film. And when you stack that up so big, you can save terabytes of information on that. And the nickel, that thing will last, they tell me, hundreds of thousands of years. So you're essentially preserving all of that art for the future. It is a time capsule into the future. And that's essentially what we do.
Samuel, I like that last line. And that's essentially what we do, as if it was going to the grocery store to pick up a loaf of bread. Well, how much of your time do you spend with this enormous project, organizing this and technically thinking of this? And how much time do you spend in contemplation and writing? How do you divide your life?
You just follow the flow is basically it. At the moment, I haven't had much time for writing because the deadlines for the launches are coming up. Our first launch is happening in May or July of this year. I've got a poem flying up in May on the Artemis 1 mission.
I just have to stop you. I have a poem flying up on the Artemis. I just had to hear that twice.
It's funny, right? Because what it is that I was one of the first to realize that this was possible. Anyone could have done it, really. It's just realizing that you can buy space on a rocket and then you can fill it with whatever you want, right? And basically my choice was to fill it with the art of the world.
And are you being supported enough by institutions, by agencies, by funders?
At the moment, this is all self-funded. I've got a private company called Incandence. Incandence does all my publishing work. It does all the work for consultation that I do with technology companies and other companies. So this is a special project under Incandence, and we're basically taking care of all the costs. So any profit that my company makes in its other work is going into this. We haven't had any outside funding at all.
Samuel, this is holy work you're doing, because what you have dedicated your life to is furthering other people, their wishes, their dreams, their stories. You have said, I am going to do something with these that never has been done before.
I must say, though, sorry, Grace, that although we haven't gotten a lot of funding outside, and I haven't really looked, is that we're supported by masses of people who believe in this dream. People like Didi Menendez, people all over the world, the publishers of Fine Arts Connoisseur magazine, Beautiful Bizarre magazine, Arts Renewal Center, the Bennett Prize, so on and so forth. So many people have come together and said, look, we will do this for you. Everything that we curate, we'll forward to you, and you can do this. And that has helped me a lot. Even though it's not financial, it's not monetary, that's an amazing amount of help that we've gotten from the arts community and gallerists, curators, editors, anthologists all over the world.
That is certainly a currency better than money, perhaps. Definitely. And the fact that you are just making this happen and no one else ever has before. What kind of a little boy were you? Tell me about this little boy, Samuel Peralta. Were you building rockets in the backyard at 5 years old?
I started writing poetry when I was very young. I've still got the little spiral notebooks that my mother saved, where I have my very precocious rhymes in them. And I don't know, maybe I'll send that little book up as well, but I never thought of it. Now you bring it up to mind. And when I was in my teens, I built model rockets. I was in California at that time, and there was a company called Estes that made model rocket building very easy. So I would go out to the field with my model rockets along with my little club, and we would shoot rockets up in the sky. And that was my first encounter with space. At the same time I was doing that, they were building the first of the space shuttles, and the space shuttles were being readied for flight. At the same time, I was immersing myself in science fiction. So that confluence of my love for poetry and the arts, which I attribute to my parents, and my love for science coalesced together all throughout my life. You can see it in my poetry. The first poem I read, Resurrecting the Dinosaur, was essentially melding gene and DNA technology with resurrecting a lost love. And so I find a lot of my metaphors in poetry in the language of science. And that's something that makes, I think, the way I speak in my words unique.
I bet you were the smartest kid in a senior class.
I was not, but I was one of the hardest working.
Oh, now there's a lesson for everyone. And so, Dr. Peralta, when did you receive your PhD?
Oh, gosh, a long time ago.
Okay. I said to someone, I bet he's a boy wonder, you know. I bet he was a genius when he was a kid. But what you're telling me is that the wish and the desire is very powerful to get what you want.
It is. You've got to keep striving. You have a vision, you have a dream, you've got to keep going for it. And you may not reach the dream that you thought you would, but you will reach a dream.
And Samuel, you are a testament to that. And you are saying that we're all entitled to do the most that we can wherever we are. And you did the most that you can. But now we want to hear another poem. This is The Poet and the Poem. And Samuel Peralta is our really miraculous and beautiful human being who is a poet.
This one is going to be a little unusual. I like working with form in poetry. And in this poem, I decided that I would tackle the limerick. And it's a series of limericks, four limericks. And I thought I would change it up a little bit, because limericks are usually humorous. So I decided to tackle the story of JFK Jr. in a series of limericks. This is called Flying to Nantucket. I have set out a course for Nantucket, seeking wind with my wings out to tack it. But my heart, it lies shattered off the hurricane-battered south shore of the island Nantucket. This July, I'm following his flight with his wife and her sister that night, past Point Judith over water, along the path that was shorter and away from the coastline's faint light. Did he know what was going to come when the fog rose, embalming their son? Did she try to stay calm, put her hand on his arm, when she knew day was finally done? I've set out my course past Nantucket, forging north with my compass to track it. But my heart, it lies torn beneath waters forlorn as I fly past Nantucket.
That is really interesting, to take a tragedy and put it in rhyme. Just actually floats it a whole different way, doesn't it? It makes it much more able to be said because of the mellifluous way you phrase it. But it's a very painful story, isn't it?
It is. And I tried to show that any form can be made to do what you wish. Mm. A form as humorous as a limerick can be made to impart something painful.
I'm going to teach that and credit that as a Peralta form, to take a limerick and to take a tragedy and put it into that form. That is, I haven't heard it done before. That is a good one. Well, you have edited some 13 science fiction books, some chronicles, among many, many other things. But do you think science fiction actually is a precursor to reality, that it does predict what scientists will find out?
I think what science fiction does is it actually talks about the present. It really doesn't talk about the future. What it does is it puts present social situations in a world that looks very different and is from the future, but at its heart, it's a commentary on the issues that we see today. So, for example, we talk about whether robots are human or not. Really, it's a social commentary on whether we as humans value people who are of different skin color or different gender or a different orientation. And the robots are a metaphor for that other that we want to, that we keep saying are others, although they are just like us.
Are your short stories dealing with this?
All my short stories are very conscious of this, that I'm using the language of futurism to comment about the current.
The present. And your work has been on the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and Amazon bestseller lists, as well as worldwide awards for literature. Well, when you do produce these, when you edit these chronicles, do you engage a writer and give that writer space to write, or do you take a finished product and edit it? Or how is that umbrella as editor? How does that work with your...
It's very similar to the way that things are curated in the Poets and Artists group. You center on a theme. So for example, I'd say the theme for this anthology is going to be about cloning. So it becomes something called the Clone Chronicles. And that doesn't exist yet. It may in the future. And then that just gives everybody leeway to write about that. So you invite some folks to write, and within that theme, they're free to write. And as long as what they produce is good and speaks to me, then it gets included in the anthology.
I see. We'll look it up because it's on your website and it's on Amazon, I know. Now, have you consulted on artificial intelligence? Is it one of your interests?
Artificial intelligence is indeed one of my interests. I'm not as advanced as other scientists on it, but one of the things that I am doing is I'm working with a few scientists to push artificial intelligence to new limits. One of the work I'm doing right now is collaborating with an artificial intelligence called OSUN, who is programmed by a friend of mine, Yudha Wijeratne, who's from Sri Lanka. And he actually produced OSUN. And what he did was he programmed it. He used machine learning and he taught this machine on some Chinese poetry. And it spouted out some words that looked very good, but not quite there, if you know what I mean. It had gemstones. So I consulted with him and I said, let's put together a database of good poets. And what we'll do is I fed this AI the poetry that I base my own poetry on, my own influences. So there were bits of Neruda, Lipo, and William Carlos Williams and T.S. Eliot and all sorts of people. And what we did was we formed the language that this AI could understand. So it began looking at that and it began putting out material that was actually very good, but we're not at the point where you could say that they're poetry yet. poetry there yet. So when I say I'm collaborating, what it means is I go in and I work as an editor, so to speak, with the raw material that is put, that is produced by this AI, and I try to minimally adjust it so that there is meaning to the near doggerel that comes out. And when you do that, when you put the human hand in the AI, you can produce things that are of great beauty, actually.
And this is holy work. It's holy work. It's collaboration with something bigger than we are, I think. So do you think that the words will be connected randomly and create new poems? Or is it just...
I think what happens is the AI output is like a palette of paint. You have your colors, and what happens is you use these colors to paint something. So as poets, we have a vocabulary, whatever language you're in. For me, it's English, and you have this, and you work with certain metaphors and vocabulary. But when the AI comes out and produces words, you use that as a different, as part of that palette vocabulary of words to produce a new work. When I went in, I started to do this, I thought of myself as a translator or an adapter. I also adapt works from the Japanese. I don't speak Japanese myself, but I have maybe 5 or 6 friends who do speak Japanese. And they produce literal translations for me, or their own translations. And what I do is I take that and I adapt it into poetry. And you can find some on my blog. But what I did is I looked at the output of the AI and I thought to myself, what if this AI were somebody speaking in Japanese, trying to speak in English, and they couldn't quite speak English well enough? So they're producing this work. And it looks like gibberish, but it's just a foreigner who's not very adept at English.
And you're the tweaker. You're tweaking it.
That's right. And so I look at it and I say, there's some sense in it, but he missed it. So I tweak it a little bit so that it becomes intelligible in English and it says something. So I've essentially translated the AI into something that we can appreciate.
And we can appreciate you. Let's hear another poem.
This is a poem based on a challenge that I put to myself to produce a poem based on a recipe. So it's called Sustenance. Ingredients: 3 pounds pork shoulder, cubed to 1 inch size, 1 cup orange juice, sour to bitter, 1 hot green pepper, diced, 1 large onion, finely chopped, 1/2 cup sliced shallots, 1 teaspoon each of salt, black pepper, thyme. On the kitchen television, the evening programming brings in the latest from Port-au-Prince, a different litany of figures, 7.0 magnitude, 245,000 buildings destroyed, over 160,000 dead, 3 million injured and homeless. And here in my chef's kitchen, I am preparing griot, a calorically sinful dish we'd fallen improbably in love with on a trip 5 years past. Paired with riz jeonjeon, an exquisite side of rice sautéed in garlic and butter and a type of tiny aromatic mushroom from the northern sweep of Haiti. Everything in a large pot, marinated overnight in the refrigerator so that the flavors infuse the meat. Placing the pot on the stove, I fill it with water until it just covers all the mixture, then bring things to a simmer. 45 minutes. But nothing is the same anymore. Not the Cathedral Notre Dame de l'Assomption or its lighthouse cupola where we made our pledges. Not Pétionville where you shared me banana pensée under Antillean sunshine. Not l'Université d'Été where I rediscovered love only to lose it. I'm tearing off the mushroom stems now, the inedible parts, like the pieces of our lives we cast off, bury, try to forget, hoping that it leaves us more whole than we were before, hoping that this time we will not taste that caustic undertone, acerbic and bitter. Like a dispassionate oracle, the televised satellite stream pronounces its dreadful aphorisms near the epicenter. An obliterated Léogâne, Petit Goave destroyed, a Jacmel broken and desolate, the holocaust of a Port-au-Prince put asunder by the Earth's titanic shrug. And I am consumed by the immensity of it, drowned in the loss of you, overwhelmed by the triage of Haiti, my heart and the demands of this griot, this melange of memories that was to be my comfort food, burning in oil, one half cup of despair, and suddenly I'm texting over and over, Yele, Yele, Haiti, to the number scrolling on the periphery of my vision, sending out pieces of my soul to wander among the dispossessed, to assuage the hungry, trickling droplets to the thirsty stream, trying in desperation to stem this raging, inexhaustible fire.
Samuel, nothing is the same anymore. That is a masterpiece. I hope it is heard by thousands. I hope it lands on the moon. And before we have a final poem, what do you want to do next? You've done more than a dozen PhDs. What do you want to do that you have not done?
I'm going for the Olympics. No, I don't know what I'm going to do next.
Surfing. How about surfing?
This little card that I showed you earlier, that's been tested in the high seas Mars simulation facility in Hawaii, where NASA tests its Mars exploration units and trains its astronauts. So if ever there's a situation where we're off on a trip to Mars, we're ready.
Well, I hope that you're on the cover of Time magazine next. And as the man of the year, let's have a final poem.
This is a poem that I've adapted from Kotaro Takamura. I talked to you a bit before about this Japanese poet that I was adapting. And the translators who have read this poem essentially say that my adaptation is closer to the original than their own translations. So, which was a compliment I really like. It's called, How More Beautiful You Are. How more beautiful you are, with every veil, every adornment shed. Your body, by the wash of years refined, boundless like a meteor. Your soul, insubstantial to vanity or scandal, moving swiftly as desire. How long, centuries, before this consummation into woman? There, wrapped in your silence, it is as if you were creation's first triumph. Ah, sometimes my heart leaps me amazed, how more beautiful you are. Thank you, Grace.
Sam Peralta, Dr. Peralta, sometimes you leave us amazed. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We wish to thank our funders, the Sinipet Fund, the Renata Foundation, Avi Deshashani, Sandy Jackson Cohen. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.